It's
nice. Wow. No, not so much light. Okay. Wonderful to not see you, because I really do not see you. I just see the clock ticking, how much time I have. So it's good that you're here. It's good that it's 10 p.m. and it will soon be drunk somewhere in a bar, hopefully. First of all, my name is Johannes, and I have a strange accent. I'm from Austria, that's why the accent. And the next announcement, I do not have any slides. I'm so sorry, no slides. You have to listen to what I'm talking. That's the important part here. Okay, so, and today I want to talk about Snowden's critical fucking flaw. And I mean, for those people of you like who know about Herrschaftstheorie, as we call it in German, you can actually go. And the rest, maybe I can try at least to enlighten you a little bit. So back in the good old days in 2015, Shami Chakrabarty wrote an opinion piece for The Guardian and stating that Edward Snowden, quote, is a hero. She claimed that saying so didn't make her terror, it made her a firm believer in democracy and the rule of law. Many saw and still see it this way, so Snowden is the true protector of freedom, and I hear it frequently in hacker circles echoing like a prayer in a church. He is a freedom fighter. He's standing for the American ideal codified in the Constitution. So the state apparatus, and not Snowden, deserves our disgust and derision. And, well, let's say yes and no, okay? I think there is a fatal misconception going on, and we have to talk a little bit about it, because way too many people, I think, step on this ideological turd, and let's talk about this ideological turd a little bit, okay? So I'll try to explain what the fallacy is, and might use some curse words doing it. Fuck! Okay, good. So let's get started with the common perception of the cause. The growing tech industry and its changing dynamics resulted in questions of privacy and of shared information through various telecommunication platforms. The issues of the dragnet surveillance and the snooping of the National Security Agency since 9/11 have remained a questionable practice that was defended as a measure of preventing terrorist attacks. So Edward Snowden, and you probably all know this already, was a former contractor for the CIA, and he leaked details to the media in June 2013 about extensive phone surveillance by the American intelligence units. The information provided by Snowden had various implications on the future of free speech, government-endorsed law-breaking in the United States, and privacy rights, of course. Despite several people demonizing him as a traitor who endangered the safety of the United States, others referred to him as a hero who tried to protect the freedom of privacy of all American citizens. So Snowden stated that all interpersonal communication is automatically recorded with details of email, passwords, credit information, phone calls readily available for the surveillance agencies. So Snowden defines freedom as the ability to carry out an individual's free will. And consequently, this breach of privacy by the government is interpreted by Snowden as an act of dictatorship and a violation of the constitutional right to privacy. Therefore, if individuals cannot communicate without being observed, then they are unable to exercise their freedom. So he provides the revelation of this information due to the fear of the horror vision of Orwell's 1984 turning into reality, whereby complete surveillance of the people is exercised, and that's this resulting in, quote, the end of freedom. Okay, the view of the government now, as stated by then President Barack Obama, who was also not that cool, was that for total security to be achieved, 100% freedom cannot be guaranteed, since the duty of the government is to protect its citizens. Therefore, he argued that for the state to provide civil security, it has to give an allowance for a few losses with regards to freedom. For the public right to protection to be achieved, a certain degree of surveillance must be allowed. Despite the government owing freedom to its citizens, it is tasked to also ensure their security. Thus, in cases of the possibilities of danger, statements argue, like Obama, that surveillance is necessary. For instance, it has been claimed that the state was able to prevent various instances of Islamist attacks by carrying out inspections, etc., etc., etc. So let's talk about the argument that the government not only owes freedom to its citizens, but also security. This argument is made plausible by the government via hints at existing dangers. What is it then that the state protects its citizens against? If we want to take that claim seriously, it protects them against a danger the state has exposed them to in the first place. Right or wrong, the fact is that the native countries of terrorists feel oppressed, and above all, it doesn't really matter with what kind of program those Al-Qaeda or whatever guys react to the Western domination of the globe. They are reactions to the Western domination and utilization of the globe, period. And Al-Qaeda holds against the West that the bad conditions their countries are in have somehow to do with the exploitation and military domination of their world regions by the West. Of course, you can debate a lot about that, if it's true or it's not true, but in a certain way, that's how those guys see it. In short, if citizens in the centers of capitalism, like Germany, England, Spain, the USA, are threatened by Islamist terrorists, then it's because all over the world, their states operate as controlling powers and create enemies for themselves. So if the state protects the people against something, then it's against enemies that the state created in the first place, that are of its own making. Terrorists are fighting, of course, a compensatory war for the simple reason that they are in no position to fight a real war. They are nowhere able to attack the real power sources of the Western states. The people, for example, they hit on 9/11 or in Madrid are nothing more than mere representatives of the enemy state and are definitely soft targets, since there are no ways that terrorists would actually hit the hard targets. Again, it is the Western states that expose their citizens to this kind of danger, namely by creating enemies for themselves, which in their turn also attack citizens as mere representatives of the state. And if states prevent attacks, then thereby protect first and foremost their own inviolability. When the state claims to protect its citizens, what does it actually protect them from? It protects them from, in some way, from criminals. And what actually is it that the state protects them from? Well, from those who break its laws, and that's very important. If we want to be precise, we have to recognize that here, too, the state does not protect its citizens, but the state protects its law. Now, if we want to be brutally honest about it, we can say this. The state offers no protection to those, for example, drowning in the Mediterranean Sea by the thousands, or those who were harmed at the US-Mexican border. Of course they are not protected. And why? Well, for the simple reason that their immigration is illegal. Yeah? Protection is for the law and not for the people. The state also doesn't protect its citizens from the loss of their retirement provisions, for example, through bad speculations of banks they entrusted with their money, a total catastrophe to the person affected by it. As for the state, it is merely a question of whether or not the bank has violated regulations. If it hasn't and only speculated badly, there is no protection against it. The state also doesn't protect people against dismissals, unemployment either, which is also a social catastrophe to whoever is hit. But unemployment and dismissal is an employer's good right, and it is legal, so there is no protection against it. Again, it's a question of what is a law and what is illegal within this law. Does the state protect people, for example, from thieves? Like a super simple question. Well, strictly speaking, the state yet again merely protects its law and not the citizens. It usually works like this. If somebody becomes a victim of theft and subsequently reports it to the police, an investigation is launched, and if caught, the thief gets punished, of course. And in most cases, the poor devils that commit theft have nothing that can be taken from them, to the effect that the citizen affected by the theft gains absolutely nothing from the punishment of the thief, nothing at all, especially no repair of the damages incurred. Only the damages to the law incurred are repaired through the punishment of the thief. So strictly speaking, when Obama says freedom needs security and that we need to protect and we are protecting our citizens, one has to say that in reality, the state does not protect its citizens, but protects its law. It protects its own self. And more often than not, the state's self-protection just doesn't include its citizens. Like in the case of theft, for example, as I mentioned. What I want to say here is also illustrated by the fact that the need for security that the state protects, namely its own, is always much more fundamental and comprehensive than all examples of dangers that those in charge could, if necessary, enumerate. The state does not wait with its protection for a particular danger to arise somewhere, just as it doesn't wait for an external enemy before it puts an army into place. A state always has an army. It doesn't create an army when a war starts. Okay? The objection of protection, which Obama, the object of protection which Obama claims to be the citizen, is first and foremost the sovereignty of the state itself, the unimpeachability of the monopoly of force, the ability of the sovereignty to everywhere impose and safeguard obedience for its own laws, and the guarantee that the authority in place has its society under control. To the monopoly of force, the first object of protection is itself, and that's very important. And it is indeed the first condition with which the political authority, with its rules and regulations, governs society and maintains order by monopoly of force. And the state subjects all citizens to this principle. Everything that the state establishes, creates, issues, and enforces presupposes the inviolability of the monopoly of force. And that includes the freedom it grants. So you hear right, freedom is something that the state grants. You don't have it. Maybe it is worth briefly recalling that this is nothing really new. The political authority has always supervised society, firstly and simply in the form of judicature and the justice system. They keep an eye on whether the citizens obey the law in their conduct, whether they act within the framework of what is permitted. We want to bear in mind that the judicature is a curious thing, since it expects both the citizens' obedience to the law and their breaches of them. So on one hand, one expects the citizens to obey the law on the whole, and on the other hand, the entire criminal code that exists already anticipates all violations that are possible. They very well know all the mistakes the citizens could make and are dead sure to make. But in the field of justice, the state is relatively lax. Investigations are generally not launched until after offenses. A charge has to be filed, or it has to become known to the public prosecutor that somewhere laws have been violated. And then inspectors, police officers are sent out to do what Colombo has been doing since 1971. So, however, precisely because of the fact of being tied into permissions and prohibitions, the limitation of the citizens' framework for action always brings about political discontentment as well, a will to rectify the organization of the state right up to anti-constitutional activities or revolutions. Therefore, in every free state, there exists, apart from judicature and justice, something else too, the domestic intelligence services, the organs of state security. With those organs, every democracy actually proves that it isn't willing to act as the executive organ of an autonomously developed will of its citizens, but that, on the contrary, the authority sets the framework in which the citizens' will is allowed to be critical, is allowed to be critical. It's important to repeat this, because most people actually haven't thought about it that way. So it allows the citizens to be critical within a certain framework. It isn't whatever the democratic process of opinion formation brings about in terms of political opinions and options that the democratic state leadership acts upon. But instead, with its domestic intelligence service, it dictates the direction the process of will formation is allowed to take or not. So we also should not forget that. It dictates the direction of the process of the will formation allowed to take place. In this field, it isn't that the security organs only become active after the deed. In this case, it has always been commonplace they act in advance. Of course, because they're acting against so-called enemies of the state. But now comes the most important part here, and we have it here with the flaw. All of this, what I'm talking about here, all of it is not in any way a contradiction to freedom. It merely shows what freedom actually is, namely a license given by the authorities. It's a license by the authorities. The idea that freedom is when the state is not part of the equation, freedom is where the state is absent, is a huge misconception. Freedom is a political definition of the citizen's will that the state power proposes. What we call freedom does not exist without a state. Freedom is an authorization from above to make us, to make use of one's will within the concessions and prohibitions that are imposed upon it. So freedom is not passed in any other way. It always comes with the conditions and restrictions that are part of its exercise. There exists, in this respect, a significant confusion that is held in high esteem by everyone. Freedom as understood by the citizen, of which Snowden is the more radical representative. Freedom as Snowden views it is understood by the citizen as though it were an integral part of himself or herself. It's been thought of as a sort of pre-governmental human trait, the idea that my freedom does not need a state. It is thought of as an anthropological characteristic that is part of the human being because the human's will is free. But freedom in society, political freedom, is not the same as free will. Instead, it is the rule that dictates how it should be exercised. Thus, this also means that freedom is not the opposite of sovereignty. Political freedom, on the contrary, is a particular way in which people exist under governance. So political freedom is a concession to the citizens and obligation of the citizens by the state. And of course, this concession is not limitless. This becomes particularly clear when one thinks about the material aspect of freedom. In short, as long as one is alone in bed, no demands are made upon one. However, as soon as one enters the social sphere, freedom means a relation to other people. To what point does my will count? And to what point does, you know, like yours count? If this is the question, then it is clear that the material side, the real tangible side of freedom, and this is important, is private property. It is the sphere in which I freely dispose of something. And Hegel puts it beautifully when he says that freedom needs an outer sphere of reality. And what is the outer sphere of freedom? It is the free disposal of what belongs to me. And it quickly becomes clear that ends where that which belongs to somebody else begins. And there's the interaction going on. Yeah? Within the context of this freedom, I decreed, within this context of freedom is decreed, well, I should probably... Okay. So mine and yours, that's important. Good. Within the context of this freedom is decreed that lots of private owners interact, and that indeed they, each one of them with his or her property, try to take advantage of the other when they exchange. Whether they exchange work capacity against salary or product against product is unimportant. When private owners come into contact, then this means competition is on the agenda. And this situation is simply untenable without violence, without a violence-induced rule about how far you are allowed to go and where it ends. Private property needs the freedom granted by the state, and it needs the police and other state entities to maintain order, to maintain this freedom. So freedom, real freedom, which means the one that exists and not the imaginary one when a person is alone in bed. So the actual freedom is a politically decreed relation of will between people. Your will applies up to the point where another will applies. And it is the state that determines where the border between the two lies with its laws and its property protection. So this type of freedom is not abolished, like Snowden says, through surveillance of society. But on the contrary, it needs it and lives through it. It is indeed a reliable and maintainable way of organizing life within capitalist society. A truly maintainable, unavoidable constraint for all parties involved. That is, only if and only as long as the monopoly of violence is really able to maintain its sovereignty over society. This is why the state still reassures its citizens that it does not wish to abolish freedom. And it's absolutely true. It really does not want to abolish freedom, not the freedom that we are talking about. Important. The freedom... This freedom is precisely organized via the submission of the entire society under the command of the constitutional state and by making sure that everyone operates within the framework of what is permissible. Worried citizens should not worry. That's a quote by the German Minister of the Interior. And that guy said that he really doesn't want to probe into private lives. He said that as part of the whole Snowden discussion. The state, according to the German Minister of the Interior, the state is not interested in the love whisperings of Tom, Dick, and Harry. And that is probably actually really true. The state is really not interested in the love whisperings of some guys. But let's not forget the other side of the coin. Firstly, that it really is nothing but love whispering, right? And if that is so, the state does not care but to make sure that it really is just that. Everything gets screened. So after all, engagements, for unauthorized activities also take place in the private sphere, where else? So, and then comes the Minister for the Interior and says, like, don't worry, we don't investigate everyone, as if the government were making a concession here, as if the government was saying, we exercise restraint in some places. Well, the truth is that it does indeed make sure that there is just love whispering going on, which truly does not interest the state. But if the government agencies really wanted to follow up on every cheating husband, well, they would be busy until the end of the world. So they actually are really not interested in that. But in a really stupid manner, the purposeful execution of the all-round surveillance is presented as some sort of self-restriction of the state. When they talk about that in the news, they always talk about, The fact is that no such restraints are practiced. The state simply isn't interested in what it isn't interested in. To Snowden, total surveillance is appalling, and to Snowden it means the end of freedom. And the government say that it is for their protection. And in a truly ironic sense, they are absolutely right when they say that it is the protection of freedom. As I've already mentioned, freedom essentially is a relation of violence, and this relation of violence needs protection. It only exists for as long as the sovereignty of this surveillance apparatus is guaranteed. Therefore, it is no lie, but instead it's a cynical truth that freedom is protected through surveillance, in a sense other than what people think when they say it is about its protection. But actually, in a much more correct, much more objective sense, freedom is really protected via surveillance. So Snowden's fight for freedom against the surveillance state is a necessary misunderstanding, let's call it. Snowden thinks that freedom is abolished, but in fact, it merely reveals itself as what it is. Snowden is mistaken, so shall we say that he's just like a poor idiot or something like that who kind of like sacrificed his entire civil existence for this mistake? I'm not sure. So should we say that Snowden and his supporters are merely wrong about freedom and this is just like, you know, what can you do? And that Big Brother is in reality really your friend? Or is it true that Snowden just like doesn't get it? I don't know. Like, on the one hand, yes, his misunderstanding is also a really quite common misunderstanding. He's not entirely alone in his belief that surveillance destroys freedom. And if we take a look at the state, we have to admit that the state itself contributes to this misunderstanding. The state supports it. The mere fact that those in power somehow seek to keep full surveillance a secret gives in a way the impression that they too view it as a contradiction to freedom. But of course, it isn't an unknown fact. People do know that there are domestic intelligence services. Nevertheless, it isn't rubbed into people's faces all the time. On the other hand, it clearly punishes those who make that stuff public, like Snowden, and pretty harshly. So the state even pays tribute to the misunderstanding, promotes it itself. It also promotes it by not justifying its snooping with its need for sovereignty, but instead with the mission to safeguard the security of the citizens. Here too, government power presents itself as the citizen's servant. Just as government power says that it has to serve the freedom of the citizens, it also says that it has to serve security. There too, the state is willing to say, freedom is a pre-governmental right that it owes to the citizens, not that freedom is a mode of interaction that is dictated by the state to the citizens. And when it seeks to appease them by saying their private lives are not intended for investigation, this too is a point where the state acts as if it owed the citizens some self-restraint with its surveillance capabilities, as if the state wasn't allowed everything with regards to surveillance. Though it is true that with all the internet stuff going on, it really is entering a whole new territory, both technically and in some ways also legally. And it is not even clear whether the state, in form of its constitutional court, will permit itself everything or even wants to in terms of what it already practices in the form of its security organization. So there is a debate going on, even within the state. But it is not all written in stone yet, so there is still a need to make some legal decisions about stuff and things that have not been decided upon. In all of it, the state reinforces Snowden's error. And what does it thereby reinforce? Well, something pretty indispensable, namely a necessary misunderstanding, as I called it earlier. This misunderstanding is quite indispensable since freedom is simply inseparable from the idea that one doesn't consider it to be an order. You know, I hope that's clear. A person cannot feel free and say, my freedom has been ordered, you know? An integral part of freedom is the idea that it is a sort of pre-governmental legal position that naturally belongs to me and which the state owes to me, not which the state gives to me or demands of me. So one is not to be had without the other, so to speak. So, and that's the ideological turret I have been talking about earlier. This is why the idea of freedom needs the Arrhenius inversion of the relationship between the state and its citizens. The inversion of this relationship in the following sense: it isn't the state that defines the citizen who has to act within the boundaries set by the former. Instead, the citizen is a free being with whom the state has to comply and whose freedom it has to protect. This inversion simply is an integral part of the idea of freedom in a capitalist state. Whoever ceases to believe it, whoever says, I've got it, I understand now, freedom is a state-ordered mode of interaction between people, is halfway into actually not wanting it anymore. At least he or she is provoked to ask for the purpose of this decree, or to ask, then what is it good for? Why do we have a state? What is the monopoly of violence, etc., etc., etc.? This at least sets in immediately if one realizes that freedom is a mode of interaction by decree, a manner in which people are to interact, namely to respect each other's as carriers of free will, but only insofar the will of the other has a legal status. Okay, so whoever has correctly understood this is close to criticizing it, at least I had this awakening moment, is provoked to ask why it is then decreed. To be a free citizen simply implies the idea that freedom is part of one and that the state has duty to safeguard it, and not that the state has ordered this freedom to the citizens. Only the necessary inversion gives rise to this contradiction and constitutes Snowden's problem. Only this necessary inversion renders possible the perception of a contradiction between government power with all its necessary means of self-assertion and the freedom of its citizens. It is only because of this necessary error in the thinking of free people that the impression the almighty state destroys freedom is created. If people knew what freedom was, they would not be bewildered by surveillance. Ultimately, the whole civil world knows that Edward Snowden is pretty radical, while they themselves aren't quite that radical. So, I mean, many, many people say, like, wow, fuck, like, that guy has some balls, what he did, yeah? Well, all the papers that have written on that topic are citing him, and it cannot be denied that they are partly celebrating him as a freedom fighter. However, they do not completely embrace the idea that state surveillance destroys freedom. Upon reading those newspapers that propagate this material, one rather comes across the view that only over-surveillance is the problem, through services, secret services that have gone wild. Yeah, you see, when saying it loud like this, it is easy to detect that it is a critique of the degree of surveillance. it isn't the quality that is being criticized by those people, but it is the quantity, the excess that is being criticized. Their critique of excess is already full of the recognition of surveillance. So if you only say, like, you shouldn't do it so much, then you pretty much accept it. There is a lot of acceptance of what is quite necessary, but not of the extent which it is practiced. And then come the freedom fighters of the political columnists and the Washington whatever and the German FATS and blah, 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 which for a change are fanatically freedom-oriented for once. They come and they say it is unworthy of a democracy to constantly treat the majority of their innocent citizens as if they presented a security risk to society. Not to be overlooked here is the view that they should only be exempt from surveillance under the condition that, of course, they are innocent. Of course, they have to be innocent. In short, what is expressed here is that the citizens do not deserve such a strict all-round surveillance of their communication and their lives for the simple reason that they do not warrant it. The extended version of this argument goes as follows. And if the citizens are to trust the state, the latter has also to trust the citizens. If, however, it doesn't do that and instead shows its mistrust quite openly, then it is likely to break the trust they put in it. So the newspapers come to demonstrate to the state how counterproductive its methods of surveillance are. And one of the big counterproductive guys in that writing is, of course, Mr. Greenwald. They say you are gaining the opposite of what you want. You are undermining the trust regular citizens have in their community, in a democracy. Citizens do not deserve an all-round surveillance. What I want to argue is how much conditioning is already within this protest. It's simply because they are loyal that they do not deserve to be mistrusted. The other side of things is also worth noticing, namely how humble and pathetic the following expression of discontent is. Not even in the private sphere does the state look away, you know? That's one of these classic lines. Well, there are those who complain by saying, for example, yes, but as for the private sphere, it was promised that the state keeps out of it. I want my privacy. I want to be alone in bed, you know? What is the actual complaint of those who speak like that? Of those who say, at least then, when all the civil duties have been fulfilled, when I'm alone, when I have my hard-earned cash, and when I celebrate the end of the working day, at least then, I want my peace. No, at least then, I do not want to be surveilled, yeah? Well, at least then there should be an exemption for surveillance. It seems appropriate to do that. Mm-hmm. They are thereby already admitting that, of course, business life is under total surveillance and that the activities of the teachers and their pupils in school, those of the road traffic participants are constantly being surveyed, which is clear since those are the cases of conflict where the state keeps its watch on the law. But at least when absolutely nothing is at stake, the state could have the decency to look away. Can you see how humble and how submissive this will to freedom really is? After all, this type of freedom also exists in pretty much every dictatorship. There is no big difference if you see freedom like this in a democracy and in a dictatorship. To be left alone when all duties are fulfilled. Then I have my peace. And here comes the argument that when all duties are fulfilled, and all one does is celebrate the end of the working day, then at least the state ought to look away. And what is the answer to that? Well, once the state has reassured itself that it really is just that, it does indeed look away. But that's exactly how it works. It's a nice bunch of people who say that innocent citizens do not deserve such mistrust and thereby express the standpoint that if they were guilty, it would of course be entirely different. Only innocents deserve trust. Okay, but how do you find out who is innocent? Now comes those innocent citizens who simply decide to turn the tables by saying, well, I don't mind the state listening in. I don't mind. I have nothing to hide and therefore have nothing to fear either. And they aren't just a small number of people. With regard to all of this, the following question has always preoccupied the public. For example, there was this incident in Germany in the early 1980s. There was a census in Germany, and the state wanted to know about totally irrelevant things and also advocated complete anonymity. The state wanted to know, for example, how many people live in a household, if there is running water, or if there is the water is fetched from a well, if the toilet is on the ground floor or on the first floor, and stuff like that. So that was in the early 1980s. Back then, there was a huge riot by young people and old people from German society, pretty much the entire population, who was revolting and demonstrating against the Nazi state and its census. And now, after the revelations that the state is spying on people in a way that is in sheer magnitude way worse than asking if the toilet is on the first or second floor, there is hardly any outcry at the moment. So there is no resemblance between the outcry in the 1980s and the outcry that is going on now in civil German society. The outcry is pretty confined, you could call it. And why? Because a lot of people say it's okay for the state to have a look. With regards to my life, the state is welcome to read and listen in. It won't find anything. Personally, I do not feel threatened by surveillance. Well, this might very well be true, but what exactly do people thereby express? Whoever talks like that admits that freedom means acting within prohibitions and concessions. And this person admits that he or she knows that freedom ends if the person no longer abides by those prohibitions and concessions. This person says that to him or her, this is by no means a restriction, since this person does abide by everything. In short, whoever says, as for my private life, everyone is welcome to listen in. I have nothing to hide. Thus reveals that freedom is subordination, obedience before prohibitions and concessions. In the eyes of these people, this does not constitute much of a contradiction to the fact that they feel free at the same time. Though in this case, it almost means that one is free as long as one is not literally bound in chains. Someone who says, I have nothing to hide, my freedom is not threatened by surveillance, says indeed, I'm free as long and precisely because I adhere to the rules. And is that a world that we want? I don't know. Thank you. Yeah, sure, absolutely. Ah, fuck, I want to see you. Oh, I can see you.
Well,
it is really, oh my God.
Thank you for coming to visit us. That was quite a tour of authoritarianism and democracy, and I appreciate you taking us vastly through it. I guess my question, you know, you took a couple turns there that maybe we wouldn't all take, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Sure, absolutely. I'm pretty sure because, of course, I mean, this is also, of course, an ideological perspective, and of course, you can debate of that. Sure, but at least I tried to present it. Okay, please.
Well, so in fairness, though, ideology fairly doesn't exist once it hits reality, right? So the key concept here is that the ethics, in which is codified into law, is put in place by those who are governed. The consent of the governed is what creates the government. So you seem to turn it on its head and say that the government exists for its own purpose and the people that governs almost are grateful to be part of that. As far as civil society goes and the relationship between the individual and property, I think you're correct. But my question would be, for Snowden, what he presents us, the real argument he presents us, is the codification of ethics into law, in his view, is incorrect, that the government has overstepped its boundary, which you seem to approach, but from a Greenwald argument, which I think is the wrong argument. It's not we don't want to be governed or we agree to be governed. It's that we create a culture of surveillance of authoritarianism, which we see in our politics today. And that sort of gentle slide or the elephants coming from afar, how do you approach that argument that the culture that you create leads us toward an authoritarian government and away from our roots?
Okay, yeah. Wow, Jesus Christ. I need 2 hours or something like that. But it's hard because my talk was, of course, trying to make a philosophical argument, and you're right, of course, if you present a philosophical argument and you smash it against reality, of course, it somehow shatters. So my try was to kind of like put the thinking on its head, so to speak, and debate all that stuff. I think, where do I start? I think the... Okay, I hear out of your question, I hope I'm right, that the question of like, what can we actually do? Is this right? Are you still there?
Yeah, so the idea of the consent of the governed being that ethics is codified into law.
Yeah.
It's the right of the governed to determine if the government has overstepped its boundaries.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think I'm going even further. I say, the very moment we have something like a state, we have a problem. So the problem, like if we are running something like a concept of a state, that is the first step into the problem. So we actually, and that's of course pretty harsh, I think we should get rid of that stuff. But 3 minutes, oh my God. Yeah, I think that's probably even a good idea because especially for that kind of debate, it's great. We're open night and I need a beer anyways, really. Okay, let's talk outside. I think it's better because 3 minutes, I'm not sure I can really actually answer any questions in 3 minutes. I would say, yeah, let's go outside and talk outside. It's better. And then the next guys have more time to set up their stuff. Okay, thank you.